The Guardian.
There is blood in the water and everyone can smell it.
Oh yeah, I mean, Theresa May is a dead woman walking. It's just how long she's going to remain on death row.
The dust still hasn't settled from Friday's incredible shock results.
Theresa May's advisers have taken the hit as her so-called reshuffle turns out to be anything but. But with her authority destroyed, she's in office, but she's not in power.
So what now for Labour? What now for the UK? And how long for Theresa May?
I'm Owen Jones.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland. And we're joined today by our brilliant columnist colleague, Polly Toynbee, for, alas, the last, for now, in our special Election Daily series. So we have, I hope, all caught up on sleep a bit now from that extraordinary election night. It seems it was not a dream after all. It left Theresa May leading the largest single party, but without an overall majority, of course. And she's been turning to the Democratic Unionist Party in order to get herself across the line. I mean, it seems to me, Polly, there is a major paradox here, which is in order to stay in government, partly because they fear another election, you do a deal with the DUP. But the very fact of doing a deal with the DUP could mean you almost certainly lose the next election, as a whole lot of voters who we know, Young and others, turned out on Thursday, would turn out again to vote against a party that did a deal with this homophobic anti-abortion party. So what helps them also is going to be what hurts them.
This is exactly the coalition of chaos that she warned us about. It couldn't be worse. It looks dreadful. If ever she talked about nasty party, DUP is it with knobs on. And they will find themselves time and again caught in a situation where there's almost nothing they can legislate on with the party that they've got and with the DUP. There's very, very little that they can actually agree on. Queen's Speech will be one of the thinnest in history. I think almost nothing in it because there's nothing they can get through the Commons.
We were hearing just before from our colleague, the Home Affairs Editor, Alan Travis, that maybe one of the few things they could all agree on would be counter-extremism measures. There'd be common ground there between the DUP and Theresa May, especially after the Manchester attacks.
Well, remember David Davis and human rights?
He's a civil liberties guy.
There's quite a strong strand. You know, it only takes a handful now of decent Tories who don't like messing with human rights and civil liberties.
So this DUP deal, Owen, what do you reckon?
Well, I mean, the Tories, I don't want to extend sympathy to the Conservatives, but you have to be in awe about their plight because it's very difficult to see what they can do. So Theresa May's authority is in absolute ruins, but they can't get rid of her because they fear that would mean an internal civil war and also a general election would be made more likely, which Labour would win, making Jeremy Corbyn Prime Minister. They have the DUP, which is going to toxify their brand even further because of their anti-gay, anti-choice, climate change denying links to and sympathies for Northern Irish terrorism, which is ironic. And then you have the Remainers, the Liberal Remainers, like Nicky Morgan and Anna Soubry. And then you have the hardcore Brexiteers. And all, you know, how you manage that when she couldn't get legislation through when she had the majority she threw away and was forced constantly to do U-turns, which has become her kind of modus operandi. Well, they are paralysed. And I suppose from a partisan perspective, obviously, you know, given the Conservatives launched an election to destroy the opposition, it's difficult not to have Schadenfreude. But actually, for the country, from the national interest, we're in a bit of a mess. The EU regards us now as a complete and utter laughing stock. We have no prospect of strong and stable government, any form of stable government whatsoever. And we're basically now being held hostage by the ridiculous internal dynamics of the Conservative Party.
And even on Brexit, it's not completely clear, is it, what kind of Brexit comes out of an alliance between the Conservatives and the DUP? I mean, you're right, probably, about the rebels, and you've just name-checked a couple of them, Owen, that they would, you know, peel off if it was too hard of Brexit. But the DUP boasted during the referendum campaign that after UKIP they were the most pro-Brexit party, but it's a kind of nuanced kind of Brexit, isn't it?
They're a complete cake and eat it, aren't they? Because they want their frictionless border and at the same time they want Brexit. I mean, they were crazy to have voted for Brexit because, you know, they have no prescription themselves for how a border would work and nobody knows.
And what to people who are joining this, as if you like, from the last 30 years, they would think, why would Ian Paisley's party want a frictionless border with the Republic? public. Surely these hardcore unionists quite like a hard border separating them from the hated Irish Republic. What's this? What's their thing about frictionless border?
Well, they've had 20 years now of peace and of tremendous cross-border trade. So either you have a hard border with the South, in which case that ends that line of trade, or else you have to have a hard border right round Northern Ireland with the rest of Britain, and that would horrify them.
Yeah, they definitely want that. It just shows you how much the whole peace process has sort of become bedded in and become economically essential, that, you know, cross-border flow with the Republic, so that even these hardcore Paisleyite unionists want there to be that frictionless border. Let's talk about this reshuffle. Your so-called reshuffle, you called it, and you're not impressed.
There's very little she can clearly do because she has no authority, which doesn't bode well for EU negotiations, so she can't do a proper reshuffle. We all know she wanted to get rid of Philip Hammond, or it's very likely, as Chancellor of the Exchequer. He was almost completely absent from the general election.
He was meant to be the dead man walking, wasn't he?
He was, indeed. I think he feels a sense of vindication. Michael Gove, of course, is back. There were rumours, of course, of some bizarre alliance between Amber Rudd and Michael Gove on the leadership issue, though given Amber Rudd now has a tiny majority, I'm not sure that that's going to fly. But the reality is very little, to quote Theresa May, nothing has changed. Not quite, but it just shows she's completely and utterly paralysed. You do wonder, and I, you know, maybe pointless speculating, but she's probably desperate to resign, but has absolutely no choice. She's being held hostage by her own party.
Oh, I think she thinks nothing has changed.
Really?
When she came
out, she believes all that.
Well, I think almost when she came out and gave that astonishing speech, as if she'd been asleep during the night of the general election, and nothing has changed, and here I am, and she had nothing to say about, you know, pretty much losing the election, losing her majority. I think there's something very odd about it. I think there is a state of denial. When she says, I'm going to stay for 5 years, she kind of thinks she means it.
Do you know, I always get the sense she's somebody who just cannot think on her feet about even the tiniest thing. So she will always think, OK, this new input has happened. I need to go back into the room, work with advisors, come up with a line, write it out, then come back out and read it. But the idea of responding in real time, she just finds impossible. But you're right on that one, the election, she'd had time to prepare to say something and yet said this static statement. It was very bizarre.
Which is why, you know, she's lost her two trusted advisors, of course, Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill.
They had to go, didn't they? It was the medieval practice of the evil ministers must
indeed
be dispatched to make way for the king.
Again, doesn't reflect that well on Theresa May, many argue, that she's allowed her advisors to be thrown under the bus. To quote Margaret Thatcher, which I don't often do, advisors advise, ministers decide. So she obviously hasn't...
It's her fault.
So, well, you're in charge of your own advisors. If they've made bad decisions, you're still obviously ultimately accountable. But the issue is, with those two, she's apparently completely and utterly dependent on them. So during the second terrorist attack, the one in London, they were seconded from the campaign team to go to Cobra meetings with her, for example. So, I mean, that is, again, you know, she's the loneliest prime minister she's been called in modern British history. She's lost her key advisors. She has no authority within, of course, the British government, and she has no allies in Europe.
She has one great advantage, is that the Brexit mess is now so appalling, there is no way out of this thicket, that she's stuck with it. And so if they hold her there for 2 years, she has to cope with it. And whatever kind of chaos comes out of it, all lands on her head, and then they get rid of her at the end of it. Everybody else can heave a sigh of relief. I mean, it's quite a good thing, actually, for Labour not to be owning Brexit at the moment. I like Labour having nearly won, but not quite, will win next time. And not having to cope with something that is almost impossible.
So she's the sort of person in the fireproof suit who's being told, go into the blazing building, the rest of us are going to stay outside while she deals with it. I mean, just a couple of names. So Damien Green is a kind of deputy prime minister. He was a Remainer.
And has known Theresa May since university.
Yeah, they're old friends. I just wonder if that's what it was really about.
He's been incredibly wet, though, hasn't he? Because he's been in charge of...
She just wanted a mate near her.
I mean, I hoped that putting somebody softer, gentler in charge of DWP, he would pull back on some of the appalling 12 billion of cuts which Osborne had put in, and he hasn't touched it.
So certainly an eventful period in British politics, I think we can agree on that. Do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcast. It may well be goodbye, boo-hoo-hoo, for now, from Election Daily. But The Guardian's regular Politics Weekly podcast will continue with our fantastic political editors, Heather Stewart and Anushka Asthana. This Thursday, Johnny and I will even be joining as guests. We can't stay away.
We just cannot help ourselves. Now, we have a reader's comment today rather than a question. It's an interesting one. We've had to truncate it a little bit as it was too long in full, but Zeta says this on Brexit. I think this election outcome is the best of all possible worlds. You may be channeling you, Polly. Either way, the government will face tremendous disapproval. The Conservatives brought this blight onto Britain, biblical, and they should be the one to carry the can. The election to come will be fought on much different terms. So with Jeremy Corbyn, the PM in waiting, says Zeta. So this is exactly your point, Polly.
Absolutely.
That in a way, but it gets us to, in a way, let Theresa May deal with this sort of hospital pass that she's received.
I'd say she's entirely right. The whole Brexit disaster, it started as a handful of lunatics on the fringe of the Tory party, and they went on and on and on and on until eventually they took over most of their party. Eventually they wangled themselves a disastrous referendum. They have landed the country in its worst crisis since the war. Let them own it.
It's definitely the case that, she's now the one who has to carry the can. What though about this idea, and I think George Osborne, your mate from Sunday TV, was sitting next to you yesterday and you did brilliantly tackling him. But what about this view that there is a majority, George Osborne says there is now a majority in the House of Commons for staying in the single market, or put another way, there's not a majority for leaving it. Practically, for people who did vote Remain and would like Britain to stay in the single market, is there some hope? Zeta likes this situation we're in now, but are we rational to think actually there may be a hope that we get out with a very mild Brexit because of this deadlocked election?
I think so. I think what this election showed is that Brexit is not necessarily the foremost thing in people's minds. When they were asked to vote, they voted, and by a tiny majority, they said right out. But it doesn't mean it's the first thing they're thinking about. And in fact, as Philip Hammond himself said, they didn't vote to be poorer. They're much more worried about, wages falling behind inflation, a very, very hard cost of living, which isn't going to get any better. And so I think there's quite a possibility that a very soft Brexit would be very acceptable to the majority, apart from fanatics of people who voted for Brexit.
Yeah, I suppose this is, if we think about where we were just a few weeks ago, there was a genuine question about, in the media, about whether Labour would survive as an electoral force. But if you think about what the Conservatives face in the next, the economy is already beginning to struggle. Wages are starting to fall all over again. We've already had the longest squeeze in wages since the early 19th century. The only Greece of any industrialised country has had such a protracted squeeze in wages and fallen wages as this country. Things are only going to get worse. It's one of the reasons the snap election was called, of course, in the first place. It was rank opportunism, but it was done on the basis that there was no better time to do it. It would only get worse. And now they're going to end up with an absolute Brexit calamity, which they can't even negotiate properly. It is, a huge opportunity for the Labour Party, but it's worrying from the national kind of perspective. Our country's in a bit of a mess and is being reduced to a laughingstock internationally. But for the Conservatives, this is potentially an existential crisis.
And it's true that if you had any kind of agreement on single market, say, across Parliament, there would be a whole chunk of rebels within the Conservative Party. That is a split that just cannot heal. And Theresa May, what is she, the fourth, fifth Tory Prime Minister undone by this issue of Europe? It just keeps happening to them.
So now what next? What next for Labour? I think this is let's have this discussion, a sensitively done discussion. I suppose, from my perspective, I campaigned for Jeremy Corbyn very passionately the first time he stood to be leader. I voted for him twice, but I myself had huge publicly expressed doubts because of the opinion polls about whether that could be turned around. I suppose the frustration I've had is for the last year and a half, you'll often get journalists who will understand UKIP supporters and their grievances, but wouldn't extend that analytical courtesy to Corbyn supporters who are just regarded as, by the press often, as a delusional cult who are just going to destroy the Labour Party and do nothing else. And, a month ago, I was at a LGBT awards and a senior Labour MP came up to me in front of people, in front of a journalist who tweeted about it, saying, "You've helped to destroy the Labour Party. Labour MPs are going to lose their seats and it's partly because of you. You are partly responsible." And I was told repeatedly by several journalists that there would be retribution after a terrible defeat where the left would be driven out of the party. In the first few days after Jeremy became leader, a shadow cabinet minister anonymously told Channel 4 News, "This will end with the left in a box or driven out of the party for 30 years. And I suppose my view isn't now, I don't want retribution or anything like that against anybody else. But my question is, will there be a shift in thinking? There is a difference between one group who thought this won't work, but I'd like it to work. Polly Toynbee definitely in that that camp, and she was brilliant, you know, very enthusiastic about the manifesto. I think there were those, though, who thought it won't work and it shouldn't work, which is slightly different. But my question is, will there be a shift in the sense that the left in the 1980s was forced to basically often capitulate, abandon many of their key tenets? Will that now happen with centrists, and will they now accept those left-wing ideas? And I mean, would you want Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister, for example, Johnny?
Well, I mean, I think this point about the people adjusting to this is absolutely right. And the programme, that now Labour people will get completely behind that programme, what was in the manifesto, people will get completely behind. I think the issue was, I read about this a bit on Saturday, you know, I had myself a couple of principled objections. They weren't about domestic policy. They were mainly about the foreign policy stances Jeremy Corbyn had taken over the years. You know, the phrase I used in the piece was indulging various authoritarian regimes, and I think that's there on the record. I had an issue, you know, I wrote about this a lot in The Guardian, of him, as I would put it, looking past anti-Semitism when it appeared on the left. So long as it came from a source he regarded as sound on Israel-Palestine, he was prepared to look past it. So those were a couple of problems I had. But the main one was about electability. I didn't think somebody from his wing of the party, based on the history of politics in this country, could win or make gains. And on that, the evidence is in, and I was wrong. And, you know, you have to, when the facts change, you have to change your mind, in the words of John Maynard Keynes. And so these facts have changed. The empirical data is in that somebody from his wing with his message can gain seats. And therefore, I think that you have to swing, you have to adjust your view because of it. So that's where I am. What about you, Polly?
I think you have to remember how fast the facts change. It wasn't just about useless opinion polls, which were all over the place. In the beginning of May, we had council elections in which Labour was 11 points behind. And that was a real vote. So what happened during the course of the campaign was electrifying. But it was something very real did happen. It wasn't just that people were mistaken. If you looked at that poll, you thought, oh God, Labour's going to crash out. I mean, I got behind Corbyn. I thought Corbyn fought a brilliant campaign. Rip-roaring up and down the country. It's what he's really good at. And he got better and better. And he has now emerged, because success does people such good, with an amazing new sense of authority, of confidence. And as he was saying on the Mars show yesterday, you know, I am the most generous person. Now we need to see him actually following that through. It was not just him, because I think he's generous-spirited, but the people behind him as well. No punishment beatings, no trying to pull the party back together. Because the party is, you know, it's big and it's baggy and it's all sorts of different bits of it. And he needs to make one or two gestures in appointments of his shadow cabinet, not to transform it, but just one or two to show that he's a forgiving man.
And our colleague Paul Mason was making quite an interesting point, which is he was saying the Corbyn McDonald should absolutely hold and own the economic message central to the manifesto, no budging on that. But other areas where, in a way, they are not absolutely essential to the Corbyn project, they could delegate those, outsource those to other people. And he was suggesting, you know, let Yvette Cooper be Shadow Home Secretary and let her do her thing on Home Affairs, and we're going to keep hold control of that, which is an interesting view.
I think the reason I don't think there will be a significant reshuffle, and there shouldn't be, is I think from their perspective, you know, they had a team which did achieve a remarkable thing in British politics. It was a mini political revolution, some would argue, the beginnings of one in this country, particularly amongst younger voters who overwhelmingly support Labour, and one of the reasons Labour made gains, including in places that have never been Labour in their entire history. But also, he needs people to go on TV and radio who passionately support these ideas. It seems to me, you know, I struggle to imagine Yvette Cooper, when pressed, passionately making the case for renationalising water, for example, or energy or rail. She's suggested in the past that nationalisation is kind of sexist because it means white male bureaucrats running things. For example, the same when it comes to, you know, taxation. I don't know whether she'd do that. But the other thing, I mean, this is why I just wonder, with the reason Jeremy Corbyn supporters often have been frustrated with me, and I've let people down, which I'm very sorry about. Janine Ganesh, for example, he's a liberal commentator for the FT. And this is what he wrote last August. You can do analysis of Corbyn and his movement, in quotes. I have done it. But the essence of the whole thing is that they are just thick as pig shit. And I suppose that's the problem, isn't it?
He's not a liberal. He's a
right-wing. Sorry,
he's
Osborne's man. He's an Osborneite. Sorry,
there's nothing much more right-wing than George Osborne.
No, but that's the thing. I mean, do you know what? I mean, there is that, you know, from those sorts of pundits, it was just derision and contempt. There was no curiosity whatsoever which they would have extended to UKIP supporters. That's what I find so remarkable.
But that's a Tory.
Yeah, of course. No, I'm not, that's what I'm talking about.
But within the Labour camp, there are lots of people who are thrilled. There are a lot of people who's expected to lose their seats and are thrilled to find that Labour is on the point of victory. And there is a whole new mood all round, and they are rethinking their position. People who were looking through the appointments columns of newspapers thinking they'd be out of a job this week aren't.
And thanks to Corbyn.
And they need to be utterly grateful. And I think that they are. And I think that the people behind Corbyn need to make a gesture or two to recognise that they understand this. It needs to go both ways.
I'm just going to follow up on your earlier point, Polly, as well, the analytical point about the extent to which this was a surprise. It's not as if the team around Jeremy Corbyn was saying, you do realise we're going to win 30-odd seats here and all of your predictions are wrong. They themselves believe they were in line for a whacking on Thursday night up till and including 10 p.m. It was only the moment of the exit
poll. That's not entirely true, because I spoke to them all day and they had a number of scenarios which actually they felt perhaps had equal weighting, and one of them was hung parliament. So they did actually think...
So they counted as... It's not as if they thought it was going to
happen. They didn't think it was a dead cert, but they thought it was... They definitely thought it was a real
possibility. So anyway, the sense I got from lots of them was that... And they were pointing to specific areas, the Midlands, Yorkshire, where it was going to be a really bad night. And the question was how you manage that. So I think everyone was caught by surprise. I think Polly's point about the May elections is actually right. This wasn't that we were relying on polls, etc. It was an actual real vote just 4 weeks earlier. It only goes to show what an extraordinary campaign it was. All credit to Team Corbyn and to the leader himself for pulling that off. So before we go, we should do our recommended reading, perhaps for the last time. Polly, what do you bring us on the recommended list?
I would say, with joy and delight, to Guardian readers, read the Daily Mail. They have been utterly, utterly trashed and trounced. Paul Dacre, egg all over his face.
Is this the first one where they've issued a command and it has been disobeyed by the readership?
I think they've had nothing as spectacular as this. The Sun and the Mail threw everything at it and it didn't work. And they are busted, and we all know it now, so we can read and laugh with relish.
So, recommendation to read the Daily Mail. I'm sure Guardian readers will take you up on that. I've got a couple of recommendations. One is on medium.com, that platform, and it's by a sophologist called Paula Surridge, who I have to say I hadn't come across before, but she's done a really brilliant analysis of the figures so far and has dug into where this surge in turnout came, and says it's a bit simplistic to think it was all about the young. For one thing, it wasn't just the young in the sense of 18 to 24, but it was more correlated to graduates. Particularly, the turnout went up in areas with recent graduates, and it was really about people under 30 rather than 18 to 24. Very interesting. But the other point she makes is the big areas of surging turnout, which often overlap with where recent graduates were areas of ethnic diversity. That's where it went up in a big way. And she thinks it's possible that we are, you know, going for this very simplistic reading that it was all about the young. She says it suggests turnout rose most where the population was ethnically diverse. So that's really interesting. And I would also recommend from our own paper, just to show you what a broad church we are, we've got Matthew D'Ancona, who always is so plugged into the Conservative debate, saying that he puts his money on, or, you know, would be a backer for Amber Rudd for leader. And you facing him on the opposite page is Jackie Ashley, who says that it's time for those people, much like you, Owen, who were sceptical of Jeremy Corbyn, to fall into line. And if they're MPs or potential shadow ministers, they should take the job if it's offered to them from Jeremy Corbyn.
So my recommended reading, it's not so much recommended because of its merits, quite the opposite, actually. It's by Claire Foges, I don't know if that's how you pronounce her name, in The Times. Let's stop treating the young as political sages. We should be challenging the naive, unaffordable views of many under 25-year-olds, not kowtowing to them. Now, if the Tories and Tory supporters want to double down on contempt for the young, I'm not entirely convinced that will turn their political fortunes around. I find it astonishing because, you know, for years young people have suffered the trebling of tuition fees, the scrapping of the educational maintenance allowance, insecure and precarious work, a fall in living standards, the closure of youth services across the country, a housing crisis where home ownership is in collapse amongst their generation, driven into an unregulated private rented sector. Clearly, the current model just is not working at all. Young people are going to have for the first time for a very long time, a worse lot in life than their parents. So this idea that young people are just thick and stupid and delusional with naive, unaffordable views because of their lived experience, which under this current economic model is one of insecurity and declining wages and a future which often seems pretty difficult. It's just astonishing. But I think we'll see this from the Conservatives. There'll be a division between those who accept now that one of the reasons they suffered this setback, to say the least, was because young people roared across the country. They made it clear that actually you can't just take young people for granted and implement whatever policies you like, which hurt them in so many ways, and they'll never vote. They did. And unless the Conservative Party come to terms with this, then their future, thankfully from my political perspective, is very, very bleak indeed.
So another negative recommendation from you, got Daily Mail from you and Claire Voges from you. That, I'm afraid, is more or less it from us. We'll be joining Anushka Astana for Politics Weekly this week, though. So not too long for you to wait if you do pine and yearn for our company again. Thanks to all of you for riding this crazy election wave with us.
And also to say, look, this is a phenomenal period in British politics. We've seen this huge increase of youth turnout, of young people who are enthusiastic about politics. They genuinely feel hope and optimism in a way I don't think they felt for a very long time. They feel quite right power. They've just destroyed a Conservative premiership and plunged the Conservative Party into a potential existential crisis. Nice work, young people. It shows that in democracy, you can wield formidable power. So I would say, as a partisan point, do get involved. Join. I think if you people who join the Labour Party, you should get involved actively in your community. Let's build that grassroots movement. I think that would be a great transformation of our democracy.
You can follow us on Twitter at Guardian Audio. I'm at Friedland. Owen is at OwenJones84 and Polly is at Polly Toynbee. Our producer today was Gabriella Jones. Thank you again for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.